مركز صحابة The voice of أهل السنة والجماعة.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. جمعة مبارك to everyone out there. Well, there's it. Another week is getting ready to wrap itself up as we move into Friday with the sun going down. Yeah, I remember. Wonderful time, Jummah. Between Maghrib and Isha, you say 100 durood, 70 of your needs in this world and 30 in the Akhirah are taken care of. Tonight is an auspicious night to make durood. A lot of rewards. Remember, if you want to see your abode in Jannah before you die, then recite Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali alfa alfa mera 1,000 times. That's one of the benefits of Jummah night. Tomorrow, after Asr, if you say 80 times, just 80 times, what a deal that is. What a profit you get out of this. Say 80 times, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad bi rumi wa ala ali wa sallim taslima. And you get a reward of Laylatul Qadr. The angels grow tired writing good deeds for you for 80 years. The angels grow tired writing forgiveness for you for 80 years. So keep that in mind. Yeah, this is an auspicious day. This is as good as Eid. Yeah, alhamdulillah. May Allah Ta'ala give us the presence of mind and the grace to make the most of this wonderful day. Ameen. And may my ear be, being the closest to my mouth, be the first to hear. Inshallah. Ameen. Well, what can we say about the JSE today? Things turned around in a typical Mzansi style. Lots of pessimism about global growth coming out after the European Central Bank said it wouldn't maintain its the quantitative easing, if you want to call it that, its stimulus packages into the European economy because it's simply too sick and tired. The old man of Europe is Europe itself nowadays. Used to be the Ottoman Empire. Now Europe is the old man of Europe. It's old man, it's old woman of Europe. Graying Europe. Not enough young people coming through. Their markets are not growing. They don't have those huge big markets. They try and sell their goods overseas and their goods are too expensive. But the cost of living is simply too high in their home countries. So there's not much growth coming out of Europe. There's nothing coming out of the United States as well. Although the economy did put on, I think it was around about 80,000 workers last month, which is an improvement over the previous month when they only put on 20,000. But nevertheless, that's also, of course, with $5.5 trillion worth, $1 trillion worth of stimulus under Obama. You had the TARP bailouts, so that was another 1.3 billion trillion. So, you know, you're talking about 7 trillion rands worth of dollars worth of stimulus in the United States. And even with all of that behind it, the United States is still unable to raise its interest rates in order to eat away at its debt that it has. So, well, in actual fact, that also means that it's doom and gloom for the outlooks for the year in terms of global growth. Two of those prime centers of the world economy being on shaky legs. That means everyone is now starting to prepare for a lean year ahead. And that had an effect or a rollover effect onto emerging markets. And we felt a little bit of it. But South Africa, of course, we're still feeling pretty rampant after that Moody's opinion was issued. Showing we're not that bad. Standard & Poor's says they're still not willing to raise their rating on us from above junk status. We're on the first level of junk status. Fortunately, we're not any lower than that. Standard & Poor's saying we need a 2% growth average in order to break out of our current rating with them. And so, well, anyway, it looks like we're going to have a 1.7% growth this year. But, however, other economists have pointed out, yeah, but, you know, all of those estimates were made before Eskom had made its application for increases, before the petrol price was going up, before the fuel levy was coming in. So all of those could well cut off 1% growth off our country. So we may actually just eke out like a 0.5% growth for this year. So anyway, yeah, we've got elections coming up. We've got wage negotiations coming up in the gold mining sector, platinum sector, and the other mining sectors. Yeah, it's wage negotiation time, and that's also always a hairy time. And what was Subhanya? It made more. It increased its war chest today by something like nearly a billion rands through forward sales of its gold. Well, we were speaking about Anglo-American's gold sales, forward sales yesterday, and how it forward sold it, like, I think it was running about $280 an ounce, and then the gold price for the next decade. They made that forward sale for a decade, and then the gold price shot through the roof, and South Africa saw no benefits from that. How much our tax authorities, our tax man lost as a result of that, I would hate to know. Here's Subhanya making forward sales. But this is just in order to build up its war chest because it sees a really hard negotiating season coming up. AMCU has just been displaced as a majority union at Subhanya. And that means that they're going to be very, 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 very angry. Of course, that also means that the National Union of Mine Workers is now going to have to be on its toes in order to show to its members that they're able to look after their interests better than AMCU. That means they've got to be a bit more firebrand than AMCU has been over the last while, and that's been pretty, pretty hot. So, mining production figures coming out today showing that production figures continue to nosedive. Fortunately, however, an uptick in prices saw the value for our commodities increasing by 10.6%. So it didn't work out all that badly. We mined less, but we made more money. That's usually a good way of going about things. So, yeah, I suppose we could celebrate a little bit, but we have to admit that the underlying conditions are hardly giving cause for optimism going forward. It's a troubled sector, I guess it always has been and probably is always going to be. All right, well, anyway, the tail of the tape on the JSE today says it's up 0.39% at the close, 58,186.19 is the all-share index, the top 40 index finishing on 51,942.03, that's 0.42% up. The dollar has made gains against the rand today. We're on 14 rand to the dollar at the moment, so it's a slight little gain, 0.64%. We're on 18.31 to the pound at the moment, down 0.58, and on 15.76 against the euro. Against the Turkish lira, we're on 2.44, same as yesterday. We're still at the same as we were against the Japanese yen on 13. And against the Australian dollar, we made a slight loss of ground. We're just above 10 rand to the Australian dollar. Oh, that's horrible. Because you know, in essence, Australia is in the same kind of boat that South Africa is in terms of the carry trade. But you can see that their currency dealers haven't been doing the dirty on their currency as much as our own currency dealers have been and our banks have been. South Africa is a troubled country. as they say, if you want to get away from racial tension in South Africa, then it's best to just leave the country. Coming up after, a little bit late in the show, we've got Pravin has been summoned over the rogue spy unit by the public protector. One has to ask, is this the rogue state fighting back? The latest public protector appointed by Jacob Zuma, is she showing her party loyalties there rather than pursuing her job in the national interest? We'll let you think about that one, but we'll be getting to that a little bit later. We find out what Nedbank's chief executive earned last year. Mining production, as we say, continues nosediving. We'll dive down into those figures. Manufacturing output is on the up. Sasol chair takes a back seat. Africa online retailer Jumia heads for Wall Street. Standard & Poor's says the ANC talks but doesn't walk left. It talks left, but it doesn't walk left. It reckons there's not going to be some heavy land grabs after the May 8 elections. Goldman Sachs says Eskom's unbundling will take too long, and its unbundling isn't going to happen in time to get it out of its debt moratorium. morass that it finds itself in at the moment. And the Zimbabwe Reserve Bank says that it will be introducing a RIBA rate soon. A repo rate, the other people call it. We call it the RIBA rate here on our show, my show. So, okay, let's get down to business. Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan has confirmed that a subpoena has been served on him by the Public Protector in relation to the so-called SARS rogue unit. Now, this is just on the same day as the guy's name has just slipped my mind. The guy who was IPED, Robert McBride, has just been given evidence that the state capture inquiry, saying the stories about the road unit were 100% fabricated. Now we've got our finance, our public enterprises minister, being hauled before the public protector on what we now know are completely fabricated grounds. It really doesn't smell nice, does it? Who is in actual fact control of South Africa's government? One really has to ask. Gordhan said after the subpoena had been served on him, the same set of allegations have been investigated repeatedly by various institutions, including the Office of the Public Protector itself in 2014, and no conclusive evidence could be found of any legality by the South African Revenue Services or Minister Gordhan. That's according to his spokesperson, Adrian Lackey. Lackey said the subpoena had been leaked to the media while the minister was still busy consulting his counsel to determine what kind of legal responses should raise. He says that this clearly amounts to persistent harassment of Gordhan and flagrant abuse of office. And I must say that that strikes me as being that way. He says this is also another example of a fight-back campaign to disrupt efforts to uncover and prosecute instances of malfeasance and corruption in various entities of government. They should, in actual fact, get somebody who, I wonder who would qualify to investigate the public protector when you need protection from the public protector. Who can investigate the public protector? Imagine going in and saying, okay, give us the telephone calls made to your cell phone the night before you issued the summons. I'm sure that would make for very interesting reading, wouldn't it? Lackey says we must once again call on the South African public to connect a new set of dots and get an appreciation for the determined efforts to distract public opinion from the broad attempts to ensure clean governance in our country. Yeah, so there you go. Okay, well, I reckon they've said it well enough themselves. Nedbank has released its annual report for 2018 that reveals just how much the executives earned, including Nedbank Chief Executive Mike Brown. The annual report shows Nedbank paid its top six executives a total of 210.2 million rands in 2018, an average of 35 million rand per executive. Chief Executive Mike Brown received the best take-home pay of 53 million rands. Not bad. 53 million rand package includes a guaranteed 8.5 million rand basic pay, a cash bonus of the same amount, just for the because we like you, Mike, a short-term incentive payout of 16 million rands, just to keep you happy over the short term, and a long-term incentive of 16.5 million rand at face value. Well, there you go, just because they like his face, I suppose. Anyway, right, so getting on to mining production. Its slump has continued, with production decreasing by 7.5% year-on-year in February. January saw a 3.3% decline year-on-year, following a 4.1% decrease in December and a 5.2% decrease in November. I think Sibanye's woes may have a lot to do with that. Neil Froneman has admitted that the ongoing strike there, although it has been declared illegal, has hit their production severely. Stats South Africa said today that the largest negative contributors in February were diamonds, gold, and iron ore. There must have that Sibanye there. With diamond production dropping by a total of 48.3% and contributing a minus 3.2 percentage points compared to the previous month. Gold was down 20.6%. Wow. And contributed minus 3 percentage points. Iron ore, with a decline of 20.7%, contributed minus 2.9 percentage points, according to Stats SA. Platinum group metals, however, despite the depressed platinum price, you've had a stronger rhodium and palladium price over the last year, palladium price shooting through the roof, with an increase in production of 17.8%, that's in total production, contributing 2.8 percentage points overall. Mineral sales, however, that's not mineral production. This is the price that you got for your production. The price that we got went up by 10.6% due to higher prices year on year in February, with the largest positive contributors being platinum, group metals, manganese ore, and iron ore. PGMs rose by 36% and contributed 5.6 percentage points, while manganese ore rose by 44.6% and contributed 3.5 percentage points. Iron ore rose by 21.3% and contributed 22.7 percentage points. Seasonally adjusted production decreased by 1.5% in February compared to January, following month-on-month changes of 0% in January and minus 1.5% in December. In the 3 months in the quarter ended February 2019, compared to the previous 3 months, mining production decreased by 5%. Here too, diamonds and gold were the biggest negative contributors. In the 3 months, however, the seasonally adjusted value of mineral sales rose 4.4%. So we've produced less and we got more money out of it. So really, in the first 3 months of the year, we are slightly ahead, but only by a nose, I suppose you could say. We can hardly, start celebrating right now, can we? South African gold production shrank. Declining gold production was the 17th straight month that gold production has shrunk, and that's the longest string of contractions since the financial crisis in 2008. Gold output fell 21% from a year earlier compared with the revised 23% drop in January, Stats SA says. South Africa used to be the world's top producer of the metal. We accounted for more than half of all the gold ever mined throughout the history of mankind. But we've got deeper ore bodies, a labor strife, high costs, and policy uncertainty. That's all hitting output. Strike by AMCU that started in November has slashed output at Sibanye Gold. Sibanye is challenging the legality of that strike, but is also preparing to pay negotiations with AMCU It's also preparing for pay negotiations with AMCU at its platinum business. Total mining output, well, I guess it's all down. That's a second story I was just reading there, trying to get a little bit of extra out of it. Manufacturing, however, did a little bit better than mining. Manufacturing output rose 0.6% year-on-year in February after increasing by a revised 0.9% in January. Economists polled by Reuters had forecast a rise of just 0.5% year-on-year in February. On a month-on-month basis, factory production fell by 1.8% in February, according to Stats SA. Sasol says its chairman, Dr. Mandla Ganshaw, will step down after the company's annual general meeting in November. He's said to be replaced by Sipho Nkosi, the former chief executive of Exxaro Resources. Sasol says Nkosi will join the group's board on May 1 as an independent non-executive chairman designate to succeed Ganshaw at the conclusion of the AGM. Ganshaw says he's pleased to hand over the reins to a person of Sipho's caliber, says he's confident he will provide the necessary direction and blah, 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 blah that you usually say in these kind of moments. It doesn't really say anything about anything. They could be hating each other's guts. They might actually like have tried to shoot each other this morning, but you'll never see that in a sense announcement. I'm not saying that they did anything like it. I'm just saying that, you know, it's the kind of usual blah, blah, blah that you get in these times. Board member JJN Jek, an independent non-executive, said Ganshaw would leave behind a company that is well positioned to deliver shareholder value. He has led Sasol through up and down global and local economic cycles, as well as the execution of large capital projects that have faced challenges, while clearly presenting strategic opportunities for the company's growth. JK also is stepping down after the AGM, by the way. Okay, so now we have Jumia Technologies. We are rising out of the highlands of Nigeria. It has amassed in the 7 years since it was founded 4 million customers, and that number jumped 48% last year. So that means that last year they really started getting into that purple patch, you know. The first few years, You have to like get yourself known, and you've got to like tramp around and introduce yourselves to people and all of that. But once you got all that hard work, and then your introductions start making introductions to other people, and then the introductions start working on their own, that's when you know that a company is really starting to move into profit territory. And with that, Jumia has announced that they're going to be heading off to Wall Street. It's convinced the company's co-founders, former McKinsey and Company colleagues Sacha Poignonjek and Jeremy Hodara, to pursue an initial public offering in New York this week. It's planning to sell 13.5 million American depository shares at $13 to $16 a share, raising as much as $216 million. The listing is meant to give the company financial flexibility and increase awareness of the brand among investors. Often tagged as Africa's Amazon.com, Jumia has been able to grow in markets largely untapped by the U.S. heavyweight, which is hampered by lack of distribution infrastructure in Africa. To tackle the issues of vague addresses in many African cities, Jumia has built up a network of leased warehouses, pick-up and drop-off locations, and brought in a string of delivery partners to ensure reliable service. Well, there you see, you get companies, they take a look in Africa and they say, oh, no, there's just no ways we can make money here. But then you've got to sit back and you've got to say, but wait a minute, there are a whole lot of people in there who are making money. There must be ways of making money. It's just you've got to think a little bit differently, kind of out of the box. That's a wonderful thing about living in Africa. It forces you to get out of that little rut, to get out of that comfort zone. Well, we are going to move out of our little comfort zone, moving across for a bit of market news. Don't go away.
Marcus Sahaba, the voice of Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah.
Assalamu alaikum. Remember, if you want to call in, our lines are open on 010-00-1104. That's 010-00-1104. Or you can WhatsApp us some suggestions or messages on 084-786-3132. 084-786-3132. Well, I must admit, I'm kind of like wondering, what am I going to be discussing this Saturday? Kind of wondering if we should revisit Algeria. There's been quite a few developments since we looked at Algeria on my Saturday show at from 3 to 4. Every Saturday, so if you want to find out what this idiot is thinking about the international scene for Muslims, please tune in. 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. There have been some really interesting events happening with the Darb al-Islam, the world of Islam, everywhere. In Algeria, Bouteflika stepped down. The generals are saying the people must step behind his chosen successor, Salah. But the street doesn't seem to be very keen with that. The military, however, seems to be determined to maintain some kind of a semblance of order as they move to a new administration. Today in Sudan, Umar al-Bashir toppled from his throne. Not much has been heard about him. We're all kind of like wondering what has happened to him. Has he swung a deal? Has he fled the country? Is he in Switzerland right now counting his money? There's a lot of interesting things to discuss on Sudan as well. And it's really interesting. Maybe we can do Sudan and Algeria at the same time, because there are remarkable similarities in what has been happening over there. Kind of like wonder, are the Europeans getting ready to kidnap the revolution? As they do so repeatedly. People are keeping a very close eye on France, because France seems to be meddling both in Libya and Algeria at the moment. People are very suspicious about that. Khalifa Haidar, who's moving up on Tripoli with his Eastern Army, has got significant French support behind him. And he's only moving on Tripoli after first seizing control of the desert isolated oil fields in the south of the country, very similar to Algeria's oil fields. So a lot of interesting things happening at the moment. At the same time, Julian Assange has just been arrested. Arrested in the Ecuadorian embassy today. It's a very dark day for journalism, I must say, around the world. Not that we've had many bright days in journalism for like the last, ever since the United States invaded Iraq. That seems to have been a seminal point. Journalism just seemed to take it down to and from there. As embedded journalists suddenly started sending us their tomes, and our newspapers and media outlets started publishing the nonsense. Embedded journalists. So there's just no such thing. It's an oxymoron. You can't be embedded if you're a journalist. You're supposed to be independent. But nevertheless, the rot that we have in our mainstream newspapers nowadays really astounds me. How can you continue, like, you know, claiming that you're a newspaper that supports human rights, but you continue, like, quoting French presidents on what they think about human rights, and British presidents on what they think about human rights, and American presidents on what they think of human rights, when they've been, how many Muslims, how many Semites have they killed since 2001? I'd really like to know. I reckon it's over 10 million. Makes the Holocaust look like a practice game, the Jewish Holocaust. I'm not one of those people who denies the Jewish Holocaust, because I like to say, yes, you see, this is what the Europeans are like. This is what they did to the Jews. Can you imagine what they want to do to the Muslims? And they are doing to the Muslims. Look what they're doing to the Muslims. They haven't changed at all. They go on about, oh, we must remember the Holocaust, remember the Holocaust. But in actual fact, they're actually celebrating the Holocaust every year. Because, you know, if they did really remember the Holocaust, for the reasons why you're supposed to remember the Holocaust, they wouldn't be killing Muslims as they are nowadays. It's just like this Semite bloodlust just seems to bubble up every now and then. They like to think of themselves as nice, neat, quiet little pale-faced people, but in actual fact, deep down inside their hearts, oh, it's a very dark and dirty place, I must say. I mean, this is typical. This is typical. The Holocaust was not an aberration, as the Europeans like to point and like to depict it. That's why they always shine it up, because you see, like, white people were called to their pants down for the whole world to see what barbarians they are. But then you had Srebrenica coming along. It's like, yeah, they do it all over again. So anyway, France is up to its dirty tricks in Algeria and Libya. And who might be up to dirty tricks in Sudan? Well, it may just be the military itself. The military says that they want to have a two-year transition period to democracy, which of course sounds like, you know, after 2 years they're going to say, no, we're still not ready. Which is what the military usually does. Every now and then we have occasions where the military does hand over as promised. And the people in Sudan say they're not going to accept that. They're not going to accept a state of emergency. They want to go to elections. They want to get a new leader now. Makes sense. Of course, you've got a whole lot of... Sudan is, of course, on the opposite side of the Red Sea to Saudi Arabia. Red Sea is, of course, the main trade artery leading into Europe. It's like it's Europe's jugular vein. All of the oil and everything coming there into Europe has to go through the Suez Canal. Of course, to get to the Suez Canal, they've got to sail through the Red Sea, which was what makes Somalia and Sudan such key strategic points, you see. That's why Sudan and Somalia are targeted. America has been trying to keep them as failed states for so long. Omar Bashir hasn't exactly helped his own case. Because you see, according to international law, every country is allowed to control the sea off its coastline 200 kilometers into the sea. So, of course, that's well into Saudi Arabian territory, and Saudi Arabian claims for controlling the Red Sea extend well into, like, sort of Sudan territory. So that seaway, as long as Sudan is a sixth state and Saudi Arabia is in America's back pocket, Saudi Arabia, I should just call it Arabia. That's Winston Churchill wants to call it Saudi Arabia. That's his business. May he rot in hell. Saudi Arabia is the United States' little stool pigeon, and if Sudan doesn't have any real control over its own government, and the bigger issues inside Sudan, they don't worry about what's going on in the Red Sea. And as long as Somalia is a failed state, they don't demand to control who goes in and out of the Red Sea. There's a very narrow point right there on the Horn of Africa. If Somalia wanted to, they could stop all traffic, just like that. And these are the kinds of things that America hates. If you go and you look at what Britain did with its navy after winning the Battle of Trafalgar, Straits of Malacca, there, Singapore, there's another blockage point. If you control the Straits of Malacca, which is the world's busiest sea route, then you control trade going in and out of China and Asia in general. Because there's a whole host of those Polynesian islands, the Philippines and so on, Thailand and all of those countries, that ring of fire, those islands created by the volcanoes. And also you got very shallow sea in those places. So as a result of that, it's the Strait of Malacca is like the only direct way to get your trade fast to other countries. So yeah, if you control Singapore, you control the Straits of Malacca. That's what the British were all about. That's what the Japanese were fighting them in World War II. That's because they want to control the Straits of Malacca. So yeah, just like that. That's why Sudan and Somalia are such failed and states in such difficulties. Of course, France has got like over 1,000 special forces permanently stationed in Chad, which is just south South Sudan now, I suppose. And Chad's leaders have always come from Darfur. So that's why France always sends its aircraft in to bomb the rebels coming out of Darfur trying to take over Chad, because they've got a nice oil pumping agreement with Idris Deby. The acceptable dictator, you know. You kind of like wonder in Africa what kind of democracy we should have. The United States and, the traditional democratic countries, you really have to wonder, do they really have democracies, you know, where you've got two parties that kind of like can take turns in like being the president or the prime minister? It's just inevitable that you're going to get collusion between these two. There must be, in the deeper state, if you want to call it that, because administrations, public officials are there for life, whereas politicians come and go. Politicians sign debts, sign loans, they borrow money according to contracts that long outlast their term in government. So by the time that the pigeons come home to roost, the politicians are not there to handle the fallout. And so the bureaucrats start like sort of saying, okay, let's take a longer timeline. What are we going to do when these two administrations are going to mess up things? And so, like, you know, the government within the government becomes a government for itself rather than for the people. And this is why, like, you know, they'll come and they'll arrest Julian Assange in Britain, and the Brits just kind of like stand there and do nothing about it. There should be like outrage right across the country straight away. Instead, there's not, because they kind of like say, well, it's our deep state kind of like managing things in our interests according to facts of which we know nothing. So we're just going to go and get onto my Facebook page and say, Ma, I'm so outraged. And that's as far as it goes. Activism. 2 million people in 2003 marched through the streets of London. Each day for 2 days in a row, 4 million people in total marched through London protesting against the Iraq war. Tony Blair said, well, I had a bigger mandate in the last election. So there's only 4 million people. There's more than 4 million people voted for me, so I'm not going to listen to them. And of course, the generals just laughed and laughed and laughed. You know, the people go and they participate in the marches and they wear funny faces and they put body paint on and some women walk around naked and all of those kind of strange things that are apparently going to affect public opinion. Public opinion says, okay, we are affected a little bit. And then they switch television stations. All of the people who got involved in the so-called activism for the day, when the march is over, they just go home. It's not like they take the march or the energy that they created further. The generals just sit on the sidelines and laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh. It really must be funny. No, they're coming here. They're going to protest against the war again. Oh, that's very funny. I mean, what protest against war ever in Western history has actually stopped the war? It just doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. Oh, well, anyway, okay. Getting back to where we were before the commercial break. We were on mining, we were on Sasol, and then we were on Jumia. On Jumia is now heading off to Wall Street. It says that it plans to launch with $260 million worth of shares sold. Okay, we forgot that one. We finished that one. ANC talks might talk left, but it doesn't necessarily walk left, says Standard & Poor's. The Global Rating Agency, during a panel discussion, its sovereign analyst for South Africa, the guy who's in charge of all of the damage being wrecked by the so-called objective rating agency, like journalists are objective, yeah, Gardner Rusika, also says that he's objective. He says... the ANC is a moderate party. He says since 1994, they might talk left, but they do not necessarily walk left. I'm sure Julius Malema would agree with that. While the ANC is addressing historical wrongs to an extent, it has ensured necessary checks and balances are in place as it pursues land reform. So he says, I don't think the ANC will go ahead and expropriate land. If that were the case, we would see it through the weakening of property rights and weaker enforcement of contracts. Expropriation, he says, would be negative for investment and economic growth. But we know that doesn't really mean anything down in South Africa's rural heartland. And that is, in effect, a huge, big black eye for South African development since 1994. We've managed to lift some of the cities. We've managed to lift people out of poverty in the cities. But our rural areas remain neglected. And many places, like you go to places like Hazyview, just outside the Kruger Park, and it's like there's just like hills and hills and hills and hills are covered with shacks and houses. And you have to wonder where these people getting employment from, how are they staying alive? And a lot of those people were, in actual fact, tenant farmers on white farmers' land who were pushed off after 94. So, you know, this put in a huge, big pressure on township infrastructure and so on. It's not like township infrastructure in South Africa in 1994 was kind of like ready for that kind of blow. And the fact that our rural heartland remains so far divorced from the urban centers, it means that, we haven't really, as a country, are we really a country? You know, are we joined, the people of Toyandu? How do they relate to the people of Johannesburg? Perhaps, you know, what we need is a good war. You know, as they would say in America, now our country's starting to fall to pieces. We need a war to pull everything together. Yeah, well, that's a traditional route to take, huh? Are we going to go to war with someone soon? Well, you know, it really does worry me that, the horrible conditions in the DRC and Rwanda, just north of them, are like one country away. We've got Zimbabwe in between us and them. It really is a worry. Zimbabwe, there we see the police taking to the streets during a protest in February and beating people up. What happens when, like, say, your consumer base has been so decidedly weakened or wrecked either by government policies or predatory corporations, And people aren't earning enough money. They're not paying enough taxes over to the government. The government doesn't have any money to pay for roads, to pay for dams, to pay for electricity, and so on. And suddenly the government starts running out of money to pay the military. That's where the military suddenly starts turning around and says, well, we're just going to take stuff for ourselves. And when that happens, they start preying on the people. When they're preying on the people, then they start some slave labor, like we got in the DRC around some of the mines that have been taken over by the generals. Yoweri Museveni's generals, a whole lot of generals come and taken over mines, taken over forests and timber plantations and so on. And then they go to the local villages and they get the local villages to come and work for free, slave labor. Yeah, well, you know, that's what happens when your economy turns down in Africa. It makes for a very ugly reading, I must say. So anyway, Standard & Poor's rate South Africa's foreign currency debt at BB. That's two notches below junk. Two notches below junk, not one, as I said earlier. And Wired had South Africa's sovereign rand debt at a BB plus. That's the first rung of sub-investment grade. Rand-denominated debt at junk. That's debt that we owe to ourselves. That is just like such a lot of rubbish. The fact that we've got such huge rand-denominated debt should make us triple A. Should make us triple A. And remember, this is Standard & Poor's. It was rating Lehman Brothers as double A. Gave it a new rating just 2 days before it sank back in 2008. This is the same people, Standard & Poor's. They rated Lehman Brothers as double A. They rated AIG, the insurance company, as triple A. It rated Bear Stearns, also a few days before it crashed, as double A. This is Standard & Poor's. I mean, I was on Channel Islam at the time, and I was warning people that this subprime crisis is going to come and going to crash everything, going to have another Great Depression. Well, the funny thing about that, you know, is that while you're saying that, people are saying you're a conspiracy theorist. And then after it happens, and you say to people, but I said to you beforehand it was going to happen. Then they look at you and say, no, you didn't. You're a conspiracy theorist. So, you know, of the first few times that happened after the 2008 crash, I just stopped telling people that I'd said it, because you see, I'd resigned from Channel Islam and moved on to other things. It does make for an interesting little perch, this, a business show at the end of the day, having a look at things. And then you see things, you say things, you talk about things. It's very strange, you know. Most of the calls I got from readers were more like, when is a good time to buy dollars and stuff like that. Didn't really want to talk about the wider issues of business. So anyway, the JSE's watchdog, the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, the FSCA of the JSE, says it has cleared of wrongdoing three holders of accounts that traded Steinhoff shares ahead of the collapse in its share price in December 2017. There were people who sold a lot of shares just before that collapse. In typical Financial Sector Conduct Authority ways, they never find anyone guilty of insider trading. They found no reason to believe that any of these shares were traded in contravention of the Financial Markets Act. That's Brandon Topham, the Divisional Executive for Investigation and Enforcement. In all, around 1.7 billion rand was traded ahead of Steinhoff's announcement that it had discovered financial and reporting irregularities. And so before that happened, 1.7 billion rands was sold. The Financial Sector Conduct Authority coming to have a look at it said, no, we can't see anything wrong here. Move along, folks, move along. So I guess, you know, that should give old Iqbal Serv reason for hope, as he is supposed to get his IO results through to them for a closer examination, because it seems these guys are idiots. So really, Iqbal Serv doesn't have anything to worry about, if you ask me. The Financial Services, Financial Sector Conduct Authority has now investigated and cleared 56 accounts. over suspected insider trading of Steinhoff shares. Hi, John. How are you today? So now we're here to come have a look at it. Do you do that insider trading thing just before? No. It wasn't me. All right. Okay. Thanks. Hey, sorry to disturb. See you for beers on Friday. That's an FSCA investigation. Has to be that way. I mean, if it wasn't that way, there'd have been more insider trading prosecutions because, of course, it happens all the time. And it just means that the old boy network is still strong and clear. That's the way it seems to me. The latest three clear traded over 418 million rands in shares just before Steinhoff tanked. You could say that perhaps the Financial Sector Conduct Authority is, in actual fact, taking a little bit of a lenient stance towards all of this. Because if they do start prosecuting those people are going to say, what? We were supposed to hold on to those shares when you knew that these crooks had been stealing everything. You're helping the crooks. It's an argument. I'm sure it's quite a popular one on the JSE among the traders and the trading houses there. What do you do? People manage to take their shares out just before the share price tanked because of ongoing corruption that the Financial Sector Conduct Authority had not noticed for such a very, very, very long time. Well, yeah, well, they really, I mean, the financial sector thingamabob, as they call themselves, really, it is a joke. It is a joke. And I reckon Iqbal Server can relax because these jokers are not going to be able to find anything. They're going to have to send everything to Iqbal Server, sends him onto the register of companies. And she seems to have a bit more common sense than what you've got on the JSE at the moment. So, a summary of the PwC investigation into the scandal released by the company last month shows at least $7.4 billion in fraudulent transactions, and it has yet to release financial statements for 2018 and 2017. Can you believe it? No wonder. Financial Sector Conduct Authority is like, no, when you guys going to release your results? They say, ah, man, get lost. And they say, all right, man, sorry, we're busy. Okay, we'll come back. What kind of authority is that? I reckon the authority is a misnomer in this particular case. According to Goldman Sachs, the people who made all of the money selling collateralized debt obligations and then taking out guarantees with AIG, yes, the insurance company that's triple rated by Standard & Poor's, the guys we've just been talking about, Goldman Sachs is now also around and is still expressing its opinions, and people are still reporting them. Yeah, I'm even doing it myself. Goldman Sachs is saying it's going to take too long to break up Eskom into three different units of generation, distribution, and transmission. Goldman Sachs sold CDOs to a whole lot of people. Then they took out insurance. And that's the thing. AIG would insure things that people didn't even own. You can go and insure somebody else's thing. So Goldman Sachs went and sold a whole lot of collateralized debt obligations to the public. A collateralized debt obligation is basically like a mortgage. It's got a house as collateral. Or a car, you could say it's a bit of collateral. You've got the car itself, but immediately it starts losing value. But, all kinds of debts that are backed up with securities. So usually mortgages are safe as houses. That's where the term comes from. Because the person who buys a house wants to look after the house because he's going to be living in it. So therefore, it's supposed to be safe as houses, but of course, they're selling junk to people who couldn't ever afford to pay it back, and Goldman Sachs knew it. So it went out and took insurance against the very collateralized debt obligations that it had sold to the public, betting that those collateralized debt obligations would tank, would turn into rubbish. And they took out that insurance with AIG. And then when AIG went under, Henry Paulson, a former Goldman Sachs chief executive, who was now then working in the Treasury, head of the Treasury, called AIG in and said, you will pay 100 cents in the dollar to Goldman Sachs. You know, usually when you go under, your debtors are all lined up and you pay like 5 cents in the dollar. Goldman Sachs, the very next day, was paid out everything that AIG awarded it. 100 cents in the dollar. How about that? That's Goldman Sachs for you. Well, alhamdulillah, we've reached the end of the show. Jazakumullah for joining us. Make dua that whatever trading activity you got up to today has been profitable and above all, halal. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Marukas Sahaba, the voice of Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah.